Good morning and welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the show, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. We welcome your comments or questions via email at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and we have a website for the program, which you can find at home.earthlink.net/radioinvivo. You can access all of our past programs on that website, and it's getting to be quite an extensive archive on a wide variety of topics, so we hope you'll check it out. And Radio In Vivo is also available as a podcast on iTunes. All you have to do is go to the iTunes site, search Radio In Vivo, and it will bring you right to the podcast site, and you can subscribe. And, of course, we've always had podcasts available on the station's website as well at communityradio.coop. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the CIIT Centers for Health Research in Research Triangle Park. CIIT is a renowned leader in environmental health sciences research and education. For more than 25 years, CIIT has contributed science that guides sound regulatory decisions and protects the health of the public. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank CIIT for its support. And Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and it is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo and WCOM thank NESENT for its support. Well, you may recall that last week I was talking with Dr. Dan Reed, director of the Renaissance Computing Institute, about, among other things, the prediction that by the year 2050, the line between human being and machine will have blurred, as people will have all kinds of implanted interfaces monitoring their health and assisting their senses and survival. Of course, we already have some of these things today with biomechanical devices such as pacemakers, artificial hearts, implanted neural stimulators, and things like that. But one of the most amazing interfaces of all is still being worked on. The Department of Energy's Office of Science is behind a huge multi-center, multidisciplinary initiative called the DOE Artificial Retina Project, which is designed to restore eyesight to millions of people blinded by retinal diseases such as retinitis pigmentosa and age-related macular degeneration. My guest this week on Radio In Vivo is one of the participants in that project. Dr. Gianluca Lazzi is a professor of electrical and computer engineering at NC State University. He was born in Rome and received his Doctor of Engineering degree at the University of Rome, La Sapienza, and then went on to get a PhD in electrical engineering from the University of Utah. After a variety of research and consulting and academic positions, he joined the NC State faculty in 1999. Gianluca works in a field known as bioelectromagnetics, and we're going to learn all about what goes on in that area. Gianluca Lazzi, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you, Ernie. It's a pleasure to be here.
Gianluca, I'd like to begin our conversation with the DOE Artificial Retina Project. Can you tell us more about it and kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of the project?
Yeah, I mean, the project really focuses on trying to restore vision to a certain class of blind patients, like you mentioned before, especially those patients that are affected by retinal degeneration. So something like retinitis pigmentosa or age-related macular degeneration, RP and AMD, are essentially the primary cause of blindness that the artificial retina is attempting to address. What it is really is a is trying to restore vision by performing the job that the photoreceptors do not perform anymore, either because they're not there anymore, they're not working properly, like it happens in these two diseases that I mentioned before.
Sure.
So in short, what happens is that when in a normal vision, lights enter the eyes, hits the retina, hits the photoreceptor cells. The photoreceptor cells respond to light with an electrical signal, and ganglion bipolar cells get stimulated by these electrical signals, and then you have vision through the optic nerve.
Mm-hmm.
In patients with retinal degenerations, of course, photoreceptors do not work anymore. But it has been demonstrated that ganglion and bipolar cells survive at a high rate, even in those patients, to the order of 70 to 80% of survival rate.
Uh-huh. So the cells that are actually communicating that information or sending those signals to the optic nerve are still mainly intact.
Correct. And that's actually what we are using at this point. Is the idea is that, can we provide the electrical signal in place of the photoreceptor cells? So given that the photoreceptor cells do not provide anymore that electrical signal that corresponds to an image that we see outside.
Mm-hmm.
And that fundamental idea is what has been really driving this project since a few years, many years, I have to say. If you try to imagine now how the schematic of these devices that we are trying to implant is, what we need is really a camera outside that records the image, and a wireless transmission of some sort from the outside to the inside of the body. So something that, after the image is captured and digitized, transmits this image inside the human eye.
Mm-hmm.
This image needs to be received, processed inside the eye, and there needs to be an array of stimulators, basically electrode arrays, that are placed on the retina that actually inject currents and essentially inject the signal that should have been the signal of the photoreceptor cells. Of course, all of this in very simplistic terms.
Sure.
But in short, we're trying to induce currents that will still be sufficient to excite the photoreceptor cells and reproduce the image that the person would have seen with, you know, in a normal vision situation.
I see. I want to get your description a little bit of the infrastructure of the project itself. As I said, it's a huge project, multi-center. Could you tell us a little bit about the various institutions involved?
Yes, as I described before, all these various steps toward the realization of the retinal prosthesis require expertise really in a variety of fields. And that's where the interdisciplinary and multi-institution collaboration comes on. The real inventor of the retinal prosthesis is Dr. Mark Humayun. He's been the pioneer in this field since many, many years. I would say in the middle 90s, you know, around 1995 and so on, he was already starting his experiments on retina stimulation. And so he's now at the University of Southern California. He is the surgeon that performs the test in patients, and really is the director of the retinal prosthesis effort at the University of Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
But as I mentioned before, the various needs for different expertise call for a variety of researchers in different fields and different institutions to join the project. Of course, NC State is one of these, and my expertise is in bioelectromagnetics, like you mentioned before, and wireless electromagnetics, and everything where there is an interaction of electrical field with the human tissue.
Mm-hmm.
So I am especially focused in this project in understanding how electrical currents interact with the retina. How can we stimulate better the retina? Can we get this to work in a better way that we have so far? And also the telemetry system. The telemetry is the process of transmitting the information from outside the human eye to the inside of the eye.
Sure.
So all the wireless connections and so on, that's where our background helps.
Okay. And we'll come back to that in detail.
Great. We have experts in circuit design, and it is University of California, Santa Cruz involved in that. Mm-hmm. And we have all the national labs.
I understand it's six national laboratories.
That's
involved.
Correct. And essentially, we are capitalizing on the technical advances that are available at the national labs to mm-hmm. realize the retinal prosthesis subcomponents, so to speak. So we're really utilizing at best the technology that national labs, and probably only national labs at this point, can really develop. So we are talking about Los Alamos. Mm-hmm. And Los Alamos in particular is strong in the biophysics aspects, and again, try to understand how the ganglion bipolar cells respond and try to image actually the response of those ganglion bipolar cells to an electrical stimulation so that we can gain a better understanding of how vision really works. And because certainly we don't do that effectively when we restore it with an artificial retina. So the more we understand about the actual vision, the better, of course.
Sure.
We have Sandia National Labs that is working on technology, again, electrodes, devices, and so on and so forth. Argonne National Labs that is working on coating materials that are biocompatible and then can coat these devices. There is a private company, Second Sight, that actually is pulling together all this technology available from each of us and actually develop the prototypes of the prostheses that are currently under testing, and they will be under test.
I see. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, why is it the Department of Energy that is behind this project? I mean, we're talking about a consortium that is funded to the tune of tens of millions of dollars at this point. How did the Department of Energy come to lead this?
And that's a great question, Ernie. In fact, it's a question that comes on several times. And the main reason is that the Department of Energy is really the only place that could put together all these national labs and all the technology available in these national labs toward the realization of the prosthesis. Individual efforts, of course, can be funded by other agencies, you know, NIH maybe regarding the clinical testings and some of the device development, the National Science Foundation, and they are funded, by the way, individual efforts by these other agencies.
I see.
National Science Foundation for more, you know, early technology development and and, you know, more general also device development. But pulling together all the technology that is needed at a certain particular time to make this device happen requires an effort from all these institutions simultaneously, and the Department of Energy, of course, being on top of all the national labs, is the mm-hmm. only one that could actually pull together such an effort.
And of course, they were actually the ones who were the main thrusters behind the Human Genome Project as
that's
well,
correct.
I think.
Yeah, that's
along
correct.
Along the same lines.
And that's a very similar concept. That's exactly right.
I see. Well, Gianluca, I understand that the consortium is now working on the third generation of the artificial retina. How will this latest model improve over the two previous ones? Can you kind of give us the timeline of how these things have been developed and where it stands in development at this point?
Sure. You see, at the very beginning, there has been a lot of learning on the device.
I can imagine.
How it works and why it works and so on. And actually, the technology, of course, keeps improving and lets us, you know, improve the device itself. So technology, the original technology was able to deliver a device with 16 electrodes, if you will. 16 electrodes really means that you have a vision of 4x4 pixels. Imagine, like, you know, a scoreboard of a football field, if you will, and that's the sort of vision that a person is supposed to gain. And of course, the more the pixel, the better the vision, or at least that's the hope. You know, I mean,
right.
Until we don't get there fully, we won't be able to answer completely these questions. But that's the exact purpose of the project. And that was a first generation 16 pixel, very crude vision, mm-hmm. but still sufficient to see something, certainly light from dark and
right.
and some shades, of course, and some boundaries, probably.
And I understand that that model has actually been implanted in six patients to this point.
That is correct, and clinical trials have been going on with those six patients, and main task has always been to try to understand again the degree of vision restoration mm-hmm. with this device, meaning can the person recognize an object moving from left to right, from up to down, and so on and so forth, and these patients are constantly involved in tests that actually aims at trying to understand how good the vision can get with this kind of device. And this 16 electrode device has been very successful from this point of view, and that brought up the idea of improving on this, on what we learn on this device, and capitalize on everything and develop devices with more electrodes. The idea is that, well, if we have, through psychophysics tests, has been shown that we need at least 1,000 electrodes for facial recognition. That's our belief, at least at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems natural for us to push the project toward that boundary. Can we get to the 1,000 electrode device? And of course, you cannot get from 16 to 1,000 in one shot, and,
right?
In one step only.
So the first shot was 16 to 60, right?
That's exactly correct. So 60 electrode device is currently the one that is being is going to be tested soon in clinical trials,
mm-hmm.
And now our targets are to develop the 200 plus. We call it. We don't know exactly how many electrodes. 200 plus electrode device.
And that's the so-called Model 3.
And then 1,000 electro device, correct? Mm-hmm. And 1,000 plus also we call the electro device. And, of course, the ultimate goal is to arrive to the 1,000 electro device. We believe that will provide a very reasonable detail of vision.
So it's safe to say at this point, Gianluca, that the principle has been proven.
That's correct.
We have seen that this actually does work. It must be just remarkable for the patients to suddenly, even at the Model 1 level of 16 electrodes and, you know, rather primitive version of vision, it must just be an amazing experience.
It is. And, of course, you know, we cannot describe really exactly how they feel, but from
sure,
what I've... From what I've seen and from tests available that have been shown and videos, there have been a number of videos also on, that have shown what patients can do with even the 16 electrode device. It's, I think it's breathtaking. I mean, it's really impressive. It's very satisfying. It's very gratifying too. And that really raises our hope to get to devices that are better, that can help more of these people. And, you know, get their people to see again the face of their children and be functional at home. You know, it's really important. We were talking once with a patient that described the fact that he doesn't have to put the hands anymore below the light in the kitchen to see if the light is on, but just the fact that they can simply, you know, looking through the door of the kitchen and recognize that the light is on or off,
mm-hmm.
It's a really remarkable achievement for him. So even the daily tasks, for as simple as they can be improved dramatically. And we really believe that the 60 and 200 electrode device will greatly improve on this. And of course, the ultimate goal of 1,000 electrode device will be magnificent for us.
Absolutely. Well, the stage that the development is at right now, the Model 3 device of 200 electrodes. I understand that aside from increasing the number of electrodes, there are a lot of other advances that are being built in as well, making the device smaller and surgically easier to implant and things like that. Could you go into a little more detail?
Absolutely. you see, the problem that we face is that you cannot increase the number of electrodes without increasing the complexity of the system. Mm-hmm. And so these two things go hand in hand. So if you want to increase the number of electrodes, you need to somehow find better ways of doing things. You know, I'll give you an example. One of the parts I'm involved in, essentially we're implanting a microprocessor in the eye. We can call it, you know, a circuit or a stimulator or whatever, but essentially it's a little computer that gets this data, stimulates the retina. Now, if you think about 16 drivers, that's how we call it, the things that inject currents in the retina, and using the same technology to make 60 and then 200 and then 1,000, now we understand if we were dissipating a certain power, for example, think about your computer, how warm it gets when it works. Right. Now think about making the computer substantially more powerful, and it's reasonable to believe it's going to get substantially more hot unless you do something about it.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the basic laws of electronics, isn't it?
That's exactly right. So what happens is that you cannot simply, well, say, well, let's use exactly the same technology, and then now from 16, let's make it 1,000. And unless you change substantially things. And that's why all these people are involved in the project, because, you know, at the beginning you may not care, maybe of some effect or other effects, but, you know, obviously you need to look to what's your ultimate goal and what can happen if you don't pay attention to some of these effects. So thermal control is one of the things we need to watch for. And, of course, to reduce the temperature increase when you have 1,000 stimulating electrodes, you need to, A, stimulate the retina much more efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not
mm-hmm.
sufficient to say, well, simply inject current as much as needed until we see what is called a phosphene, until we see a dot of light in the eye of the patient. But that stimulation needs to be as good as it gets, as efficient as possible, because we need to utilize as little current as we can, mm-hmm. so that we
because
can...
Because these are very delicate tissues, right?
That's correct. The retina is 200 micron thick. To begin with, so is even surgically is very delicate. The surgeon, you know, it cannot go in and go very hard on it and press very hard, for example, when he's implanting the mm-hmm. And the device itself. So there is got to be some caution there. But at the same time, you cannot leave much spacing between the electrodes and the retina, otherwise current won't go in the retina.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So all of this call for better technology, better improvements in current technology.
And improvements in the materials themselves and coatings. And
correct. All of these things. Yeah. Also because, you know, again, you want to make sure that this is a device that you don't access often, at least, after it's been implanted. So it needs to be hermetically coated, biocompatible, and materials that is resistant for many, many years mm-hmm. to, you know, an environment which is very hostile. If you think about it, there is nothing worse for electronic circuits than something like the vitreous humor of the eye is a saline solution.
Really?
So
okay.
Water and salt with circuits, as you may imagine, is not...
So it's kind of like throwing your computer into the ocean.
That's exactly right. You see, if you don't cover that and coat well with some material that not only coats it well now, but will coat it well for 10 years or so mm-hmm. without changing in the structure. And not only that, but on top of this, needs to be biocompatible. So your body needs not to recognize as a foreign object.
Right.
And so as you understand, and the number of challenges, of course, are great.
Well, and it certainly sounds like, although those challenges are great, there's going to be a lot of very important knowledge to come out of this that's going to apply in all kinds of areas in implantable technologies, not just an artificial retina, as we saw with the Human Genome Project.
That's exactly right. The idea is that this project will help us learn much more about many of these fields from, again, interaction of electrical currents with the human body, with neural tissues, biocompatible materials, wireless telemetry from outside of the body to the inside. And like you say, this technology, we see this technology really applicable to a variety of future neurostimulators. Again, we're very hopeful to see the field of neurostimulation in increase in importance with our advances in technology, and we really hope of the applicability of a lot of this in a number of other fields too. Yeah, and actually, to this effect, some of this is already going on because University of Southern California is also leading a National Science Foundation sponsored engineering research center. They're called ERCs, mm-hmm. Which is an ERC on biomimetic devices. So they essentially capitalize on what they learn on the eye project, but also join with other researchers that work on other implantable stimulators to restore, you know, functions like, you know, limb movements and things like that, to create exactly a center that looks at the broader scope of implantable device and implantable neurostimulator, not only the specific development on artificial retina.
I see. So, Gianluca, and I should reintroduce you to our listeners. My guest on Radio In Vivo today is Dr. Gianluca Lazzi from North Carolina State University. And we are talking right now about the Department of Energy's Artificial Retina Project. Gianluca, have gains in this area really mirrored advances in areas that most of us lay people are more familiar with? I think of digital photography that was unknown, virtually unknown, you know, a mere 10 years ago. And now we're seeing prices coming down and resolution dramatically advancing year after year, to the point where we're practically, you know, taking it for granted, and traditional photography has gone away almost completely. So are these increases in resolution of the artificial retina taking advantage of the same kind of technological advances?
Well, from some point of view, yes. Certainly the advances that really matter is the capability of making smaller circuits, more efficient circuits, and essentially increasing technology in circuit design and development. It is also foreseeable to think that some of this technology that is pushed in, for example, artificial retina project will trickle down in things that are more affecting us every day, you know, and that's how I see actually technology in general also being advanced. You know, there's some project pushed towards certain directions, and some of this technology ends up also in things that not necessarily are related to the regional projects, and
sure,
and again, boundaries came pushed.
We've seen that with NASA over the years, certainly, that proliferation of the technologies.
Correct, but certainly in 10 years from now, what I found amazing, actually what has been happening since 10 years, you know, when these things pretty much started in 96, 97, mm-hmm. The advances in circuits and advances in materials and advances in understanding of neurostimulation have really contributed tremendously to the current state of the project. So I, you know, if we keep thinking of something changing with the same rate that has been changing in the past 10 years, I can easily imagine that in 10 years from now, the Retina project probably will be talking about making devices with substantially more electrodes than what I've been mentioning here. So maybe in 10 years from now, 1,000 electrodes would be easy, hopefully, everybody to make.
Well, I did want to ask you to kind of look into the crystal ball to see where this may end up going. You know, it almost sounds like, and I understand that complete implantability is also a goal down the line at some point. And if all that is ever perfected and the resolution, you know, is brought to the point with the number of electrodes that it actually just recreates normal vision, that starts sounding like an artificial eye to me.
It could. This, yeah, actually, and you're really touching the the correct point, because you see, there is a parallel field of nanotechnology that has been evolving dramatically in the past the past several years, and again, it's very difficult to predict where that will go and what kind of advances really will bring, especially as applied to the field of implantable devices. But if we think from the point of view, will we ever be able to, again, decrease the size of these electrodes and making really these electrodes coexist even better than what we know now with the human tissue, with the retina? Certainly nanotechnology, for example, has some great hopes to bring about this kind of advances. So is it completely unimaginable that we'll be talking many years from now of a device that could bring tremendous resolution and restore vision with tremendous resolution? Probably not. I mean, it's not. If you know, if again, we look at the past and we see how things have changed in the past 20 years, mm-hmm. I guess 20 years ago, I would never have imagined that some of the things we are talking today about are actually happening. And
it would have seemed like science fiction.
That's correct. Yeah. And actually, sometimes it looks still to me like science fiction. You know?
So, on your bad days. Huh?
So if we, you know, try to forecast what can happen in 20 years from now. You know, the great thing about this is that advances happen in a number of fields, and each of them can bring about, you know, a tremendous improvement to the device itself. So again, material science, circuit design, circuit devices, transistor size, power and power dissipations in transistors, you know. And also our understanding really how to couple with neural tissue. That's one of the big things I'm after. I keep reiterating that, I know. But it's something that if we would know how to stimulate more effectively the retina, in the sense reduce the current that we need to inject to actually stimulate the retina, I think we would have overcome a really substantial problem toward the realization of even higher resolution devices. Mm-hmm. You see, basically, we know that photoreceptor cells, when they naturally stimulate the ganglion bipolar cells, you know, need tiny signals, and the signals that we utilize are, you know, tremendously higher compared to that. So obviously,
so there's a lot of progress to be made on making the process more efficient and fine-tuning it to recreate the natural process.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of things that still we don't know about even the natural process, you know, how the image really compressed, how the image of the eye is actually, you know, handled by the eye itself naturally. There is a lot of things that we really don't understand fully.
Sure. Gianluca, I'd like to come back to the patients for just a minute, because you spoke quite movingly about the inspiration you draw from the patients that even have had the Model 1 device implanted, and just what an amazing experience it is. Do the patients, once they have the implant, do they need to be kind of retaught how to interpret the signals that are coming into their brain? I understand that cochlear implant recipients need some guidance to understand the sounds they're hearing for the first time.
Actually, this is a beautiful question, Ernie. The answer is really yes. Of course, varies patient to patient. Mm-hmm. It depends also very much how long the patient has been blind. All of these are people that had normal vision in their life, so their visual pathways and everything is intact.
I see. So these are not people who have been blind from birth or
correct.
Congenital.
These are people that have been affected by a retinal degeneration. So they used to see, and then for the diseases we're talking about, photoreceptors essentially stopped working, mm-hmm. Or at least stopped working properly or fully. Certainly, the longer the patient, and again, here I'm probably branching out a little bit in things that are not specifically in my field, so I'm filtering this a bit. But certainly, the longer the patient has been blind, probably the more adaptation he or she needs. But certainly, it's, you know, there is a, like you said before, there is something extremely powerful behind this, that is the human brain. And the cochlear implant makes use of that phenomenally well. You know, in the cochlear implant, there are only few electrodes compared to the natural way that we actually process sound. And the retinal prosthesis really builds up on the same concept. There is no way we can resolve electronically the same resolution of vision that our natural vision has. But the idea is that the brain can adapt, the brain learns, and especially the brain associates certain things that sees through the eye at this point with something that he expects or he knows. I mean, there is a lot of psychophysical studies that have to go into this, and they're currently ongoing. But certainly, you know, if at the beginning a person may see just individual dots, the idea is that the brain start putting together these dots and trying to understand what image that could be based on a database that's somewhere in our brain. You know?
Sure.
So if a series of dots for you can mean this is a door.
Mm-hmm.
So this process then will become more and more automatic. That's the idea. And the more the person gets to adapt to the device like a retinal prosthesis. But this is pretty much similar to everything, every other prosthesis that you think about. You know, anybody that has to deal with a prosthesis, an artificial limb or something, there is a learning curve on how to interface with that.
Sure.
The brain is very good at it.
Absolutely.
That's the hope.
Well, we've certainly been learning a lot more right up to the minute about the brain's so-called plasticity and ability to process signals in areas that aren't supposed to be processing those signals, that it can really learn new things, you know, fairly readily.
That's correct. You know, we don't know yet fully the impact on some aspect of the vision. For example, we know that in natural vision is a very complex way to handle depth and three-dimensionality. And how that translates into a retinal prosthesis is not fully understood, or I will, you know, translate in retinal prosthesis. We certainly know that that's part also of our interpretation, like in the three-dimensionality, you know, but whether a retinal prosthetic device will give us a similar prospect to the patient or not is in question. Of course, also depends, again, how long probably the person has been blind. And again, I use the probably in a lot of my sentences now because I really... I think several more tests are needed with patients, and we have great hopes that the higher resolution device actually will give us this possibility to answer all the questions you are having now.
Right.
Very, very questions.
Well, Gianluca, I certainly I appreciate everything you've been telling us about the broad overview of this, but I want to hear about what you do on a day-to-day basis as well, of course. But let's start specifically with the artificial retina project. What is your role, and what are the challenges you're facing, and how are you working to overcome them?
Yeah, one of the major problems that an implantable device has, especially an implantable device like the artificial retina, that is constantly stimulating a number of electrodes, is of course power dissipation. So we are injecting currents through, for example, 60 or 200 or 1,000 electrodes at a repetition rate of 60 frames per second. That's the repetition rate to avoid flickering of vision, similar to what happens essentially in your TV.
Right.
So you understand that there is a lot of current that needs to be injected constantly, pretty much, on in the patients. And of course, so there is lots of operation of this implanted device and power dissipation of it.
So, is there a battery on the device that powers it?
No, the power is actually transmitted wirelessly, in the device that we're currently designing. I mean, the current device is actually connected to the hard wire, the current prototypes.
Right. Okay.
But again, the next generation, the prosthesis that we are after, it will transmit both power and data, so both the content of the image and as well as the power to deliver to the chip, to the implanted chip, through a wireless connection.
Mm-hmm.
So if you would like to imagine something like a pair of glasses that hold both the camera and the wireless devices for transmission, and a device that is implanted in the eye or on the surface of the eyes or something like that, that would actually receive the power and the data and then use this to put power and give the information to the implanted chip.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that the power dissipation, again, like similar, like we said before, similar to a computer, you know, just the fact it's operating will heat.
Right.
And the more it operates, as you may have realized when you use your computer, the more it heats, you know, and the more the fan is going and so on.
Mm-hmm. And so, you can't put a fan inside the eye.
Yeah, you can't put a fan inside the eye. You can't cool it. However, we have to say that the body is very good at cooling. Of course, our thermoregulatory system is very efficient. You know, is able to increase blood flow. You know, sweating, all the mechanisms you're aware of
sure.
that actually help cooling. So the body is reasonably good at doing that. Still, we don't want to exceed certain margins. For example, our goal is not to exceed 2 degrees centigrade temperature increase anywhere in the eye. Mm-hmm. There are a number of standards that call for this as a magic number, so to speak. That
Anything beyond that will start causing damage?
Not necessarily we start causing damage. 2 degrees is still a safe number.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly we start possibly raising concerns that we will go into an arena that may not be as safe mm-hmm. as we would like it to be. So the idea is this device not only can be designed just from the technical point of view of accomplishing a task, but needs to be designed with this other constraint in mind. So where you place it, how you place it, was the actual physical design, the layout of this, that allows us to keep this temperature below this famous 2 degrees. And we had developed in our laboratory a number of methods that actually allow us to test what kind of temperature increase you would obtain in the human body, in any point of the human body, due to the operation of a device like this, like the implantable retinal prosthesis. We use, of course, computational models, very accurate computational models. We have human body models derived from magnetic resonance imaging scans with resolution just as low as a fraction of a millimeter. So description of the characteristic, geometrical characteristic of the human body are extremely accurate, and we can simulate the properties of the tissues and actually model the operation of the device as the device operates, so real time almost, so to speak.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, so we can determine if the device is safe from the thermal point of view, and this has been one of the goals of my group here at NC State. We have evolved dramatically since many years ago. I mean, many years ago, model resolutions were very crude, and device modeling was relatively crude. Now is extremely realistic, and really gives us an understanding of how we can change the device as a sort of iterative process, where you're designing the device and seeing what kind of effect that device will have on the temperature increase, and then alter your design until you hit this famous number of 2 degrees Celsius. As you understand, you know, while this problem may not have been a great problem when it was 16 electro device, you know, it will be a problem in the 60, 200, 1,000 higher you go, unless
sure.
you dramatically reduce the currents, the likely you are to increase again temperature in the body. And that calls into action again the second part of involvement of my group, which is again understanding how we can better couple, what are the effects of the current coupling with the retinal tissues. Can we stimulate the retina more efficiently than we are doing now? So we're essentially modeling the retina and the entire structure to understand if we can alter the design of these electrodes, shape, composition, and a current waveform, to understand really if there is anything we can do to deliver the current where it needs to go.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and some of these devices, again, they can be very inefficient. It's not easy to just inject current and say, your current need to go there in this specific point X and Y because that's my ganglion cell.
Right.
Current goes wherever he wants and tries to close on the return on the ground, similar to what would happen at home, you know, if you have a plug.
Sure.
He tries to close the circuit and he follows generally the path of less resistance. And not necessarily the path where you want the current to go is the path, actually, of less resistance. Actually, quite the contrary.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It turns out that, you know, vitreous humor is much more conductive. So it tends to actually want to carry more current rather than having the current flowing through to the retina itself. So,
how do you work to increase that efficiency of its targeting?
Yeah, and essentially we
that sounds tough.
It sounds tough. It is tough. We developed, again, in our group over the years a number of methods that will allow us to actually characterize with great precision where the current goes and what are the potentials, what are the potential gradients. And from there, we need to try to understand when neural cells get excited and how. So there are a number of efforts in a number of directions that we're pursuing in trying to better understand this phenomenon.
I see.
And of course, the third part of it is that we're involved in the wireless transmission. You know, when I was talking about bioelectromagnetics, my background is in electromagnetic theory too. And the development of this device required, like we mentioned before, transmission of power and data from the outside to the inside. And again, the design of the wireless devices that allow this kind of transmission is a really important part of our DOE tasks.
Sure. And another area that I would imagine, as you perfect that, will have a lot of potential applications in other areas.
Absolutely. And you see, it is funny also that how from a goal you actually end up having to deal with a number of problems that are associated with that goal. And I didn't mention here, but you see just the fact that you are transmitting power very close near the human body raises other concerns, similar to what people may think of the concern of using a cell phone.
Yeah, I was just getting ready to ask you about that.
And you see, basically, in our group, we have experimental and numerical method to determine what is called the SAR. It stands for specific absorption rate of power.
Mm-hmm.
You see, essentially, these devices induce electromagnetic energy in the human body, and you want that electromagnetic energy inside the body to be less than a certain number.
Right.
And we have experimental methods and numerical methods to ascertain that this is happening. So while we are developing a device with a certain technical goal of delivering enough power and this much data and so on, at the same time, the design has this constraint of not inducing sufficient power to violate international standards, or suggest a standard like IEEE or ICNIRP that will regulate the amount of power that can actually be induced in the human body.
Right, which is, of course, as you mentioned, a much wider issue. The one that gets the most press, of course, is, as you mentioned, interface with our cell phones. There's been so much controversy about the potential adverse effects of electromagnetic exposures, particularly cell phones. And, of course, people talk about living near, you know, power lines and things like that. And in the cell phones, I've seen studies that dismiss that concern entirely, and I've seen other studies, particularly for some reason out of Sweden, that seem to document that there are, over long periods of time, some potentially adverse effects. Where do you come down on that, and have you done any specific research in that area?
Yeah, actually, my PhD was on safety assessment of cell phones, you know.
Oh, okay. Well, come to the right place to get that question answered then.
Yeah, that's actually where my bioelectromagnetic background came in. We were among the very first to actually be involved in that problem. I'll just give you a little background, because the question, as you may understand, is a very complicated one.
It doesn't
have a yes or a no answer.
Right.
Electromagnetic fields are divided depending upon the frequency in non-ionizing radiation and ionizing radiation. the non-ionizing radiation is the type of radiation the cell phones are. You know, the ionizing radiation will be X-rays, for example. Mm-hmm. So we know that ionizing radiation definitely have an effect on the living tissue. The non-ionizing radiation don't have the same effect on living tissue. That's to begin with.
Sure.
Within the non-ionizing radiation, there are two types of effect. The microwave frequencies, which is, again, the one of your cell phone. There is thermal effects and non-thermal effects.
Terminal effects?
Thermal.
Thermal, sorry. Okay, thermal and non-thermal. Okay.
That's correct. What that means is that we certainly know that above a certain level of power and a certain frequencies and so on and so forth, there could be sufficient power induced in the human body to actually induce a temperature increase. So that's an obvious effect. It's undeniable. Of course, can be reversible in certain circumstances, could be non-reversible in other circumstances. For example, if you heat a lot the region of the eyes, you may understand you may develop a number of problems, cataracts and so on and so forth. Again, but this requires power sufficient to heat. And then we go in the spectrum of the non-thermal effects where cell phones are or are supposed to be. What that means is that the power induced in the human body is not sufficient to generate a significant temperature increase in the living tissue. So there is no immediate observable outcome.
Right.
And that's where then the, you know, the controversy stems at this point. There are people that advocate that, well, even though there is no a thermal effect, something visible, something you can obviously notice, temperature increase, there is nothing like that, even though there is not that kind of effect, you can still, over long term, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, who knows, induce some effect. And there is, of course, the other side of the borders, the metal that says, well, you know, non-thermal effects are do not, you know, are not proven really in terms of what are their effects in the long term. And so here we are, you know. I mean, there are, for as many as you may, like you say, for as many as they argue that, you know, there is something happening, there is just as many that argue that nothing happens. And these are very complex studies, you need to understand. These,
sure.
Especially,
very difficult to design, too, I'm
absolutely,
sure.
Absolutely, you know, and especially also because you need to resort in a lot of this to epidemiological studies where, you know, you have to observe a class of population for years and that there are other factors that affect lives of people. And it is extremely complicated. You know, from the engineering point of view, again, I'm talking about this again from a relatively ignorant point of view, because as engineers, what we really look at is the dosimetry is called, which is the dose of electromagnetic fields induced in the human body. I'm really not getting, and fortunately, I'm very thankful about this, whether those fields are dangerous or not. We just determine what they are.
I see.
And then that would be the biologist's answer to the question, are these fields sufficient?
So you're
to be
refining
harmful?
The measurements.
Correct. Okay. We are determining if these fields are high enough to exceed safety guidelines. You know, there are a number of safety guidelines. Again, I was mentioning before IEEE, the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, that have very, very well spelled out guidelines about the dose of electromagnetic fields that can be induced in the human body.
Right.
And again, there are people, researchers, that advocate that in some circumstances, those may not be sufficient, again in the known thermal effect and the long-term usage of device and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I, like you say before, it's not an answer we yes. can have now.
So the jury is still out on that
the
one.
Jury is, yeah.
Well, another topic that I know that you've also worked on and studied and that the jury is also still out on, I imagine, is the impact of microwaves on the human body. Very briefly, because we're getting ready to call it to a close here, can you tell us about that?
Well, again, a cell phone is microwave, so that's the radiation of a cell phone is a microwave frequency between 800 megahertz and 2 gigahertz. You know, we're well in the microwave region spectrum. And, you know, you can use that, again, for radiating device like cell phones, but also we're trying to to use micro energy for good use, so to speak, for like for example imaging system.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been some ideas that suggest that it is possible to detect cancer with microwave imaging systems. So it's really a field that is going to grow, and again with great application to the medical fields, I believe.
I see. Well, Gianluca, it's been just amazing to hear about all these things. We've got time enough for one more Q&A, and I did want to ask you about, you know, you have worked on also antennas for wireless and other electronic systems, and we've certainly seen some amazing progress in that field over the past several years, and I think a lot of people take it for granted these days. What type of work have you done in that area, and what can we be looking for in the future?
It's a very interesting question. Actually, we have a number of people in our group that are looking at the next generation of antennas for both wireless communication, but also imaging system. Like I was mentioning, imaging for cancer, it needs specific antenna designs,
mm-hmm.
but also for communication systems. So something that enables us to increase the capacity of a communication channel. You know, we want to transmit always wireless more and more. We want to transmit video. We want to transmit all sorts of things.
Sure.
The number of users increase. Mm-hmm. That requires antennas that are capable of, you know, letting us do that, first of all. But also,
and somebody's got to design them, and that would be you.
That would be one of
you
of
and
that
your group. And colleagues,
yes. And, you know, also other advances, like, for example, antennas on fabrics. You know, we're working on antennas on fabrics for a number of applications, too. That's a very emerging field, too.
And is that interfacing with nanotechnology as well?
Not at this point, but we expect it to be at one point. I strongly believe that these paths will cross sometime in the future. I don't know exactly when.
But, I see.
But I really expect that too.
Well, we'll be watching for that. Gianluca Lazzi, it's been a fascinating hour. And I really want to thank you for joining me on Radio In Vivo this morning.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here.
And best of luck for great success with the Artificial Retina Project. That's something we're going to be, so to speak, keeping our eyes on and watching with great interest. And the other important projects you're working on as well.
Thank you very much, Ernie.
Well, we've got some great shows coming up on Radio In Vivo in the weeks ahead. And we invite you to take a look at the rundown on the show's website, home.earthlink.net/radioinvivo. I'm Ernie Hood, and this is Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community on the volunteer-powered voice of the community, WCOM-FM, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. And please remember, if you enjoy this program and the many other terrific shows here on WCOM, we hope you will make an effort to support the station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. See you next time.